Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
From the blackest corners of your mind, they call, pulling you deep into shadow, twisting your senses, keeping you from sleep. It's time to face your darkest fears. This is Tales to Terrify. Good evening, children of the night, and welcome. Ah, it feels good to be out of that dungeon, to stretch my legs and make myself comfortable back in this darkened little corner. After nearly 2 full months away, hopefully you haven't forgotten about me. With the excellent job Seth, Stephen, Spencer, and Andrew did this last month, and the hard work of our Women in Horror Month team, I wouldn't totally blame you. Thank you to all of you for taking a turn in the hot seat. I have the privilege of returning on a pretty auspicious evening. Tonight we'll be sharing the first set of nominees for this year's Bram Stoker Awards. Each year we're incredibly fortunate to have the chance to produce the shortlisted stories in the short fiction category. Depending on existing publishing agreements and author interest, how many nominees we're able to secure varies, but we do our best to capture as many as we can. This year, I'm happy to share that all 5 of the nominated stories in short fiction will be coming to your ears between this week and next, including some familiar names and some who have yet to cross the drawbridge into our own dark domain. If you're not that familiar with the Bram Stoker Awards, they're one of the most well-established awards in horror fiction, put on by the Horror Writers Association and handed out at a gala event during the HWA's StokerCon. This year, it'll take place in San Diego from May 31st to June 2nd, and looks to be another deliciously dark and twisted affair. So, if you're in the area, I encourage you to check it out. Or, if that's too far to range, you can get yourself a virtual ticket. All the details and a link to buy tickets can be found at StokerCon2024.com. Before we dive into our first set of nominees, I want to extend our deepest, darkest thanks to our newest patron, Tina Louise. Your generosity makes our blackened hearts beat a little faster, Tina. We truly couldn't do what we do without listeners like you. Thank you. The first of our Stoker-nominated stories this evening comes to us from Cindy O'Quinn. Author Cindy O'Quinn is a 5-time Bram Stoker Award-nominated writer. Author of Lydia, from the Shirley Jackson Award-winning anthology The Twisted Book of Shadows, The Thing I Found Along a Dirt Patch Road, A Gathering on the Mountain, One and Done, and Quandam. Her poetry has been nominated for the Elgin, Dwarf Star, and Riesling Awards. She is an Appalachian writer from West Virginia. Cindy currently resides on the old Tessier homestead in the woods of northern Maine. It's the ideal backdrop for writing dark stories and poetry. Children of the Night, join me for Cindy O'Quinn's Quandam, first published in The Nightmare Never Ends by Exploding Head Fiction, October 2023.
One, history. He is becoming more forgetful, Alice Barnes told her daughter. Shelley Hughes continued looking at the compact television set on the kitchen counter in her parents' home. She knew this talk was well overdue. Shelley, too, noticed how forgetful her dad, Stanley Barnes, was becoming. It was only last month that she brought it up to her brother, Max, who blew it off like it was nothing. Shelley knew better. And so did her mother, Alice. She was unsure how to respond to her mom's statement. My daughter won't come right out and tell me that her dad is probably in the early stages of Alzheimer's. Hell, I can't admit that to myself, not yet. Shelley will tell me it's just the normal progression of aging. Stanley is 75 years old. Did you hear what I said? Alice asked. Shelley finally answered her mother. I am pretty sure that a little forgetfulness is a normal aging process. Already knowing it was more than a little, and her mother would be sure to tell her so. Alice Barnes looked at her thoughtfully. I know you are only trying to help, but I think your dad should see the doctor, just in case it has something to do with his medicine, or something simple like that. When your grandfather was alive, we had a terrible time, and it ended up being his blood pressure medicine. After the doctor changed it, he was back to his normal self. You are right. It could be something as easy as changing up his meds. Shelley felt even better about it. The screen door slammed and caused both mother and daughter to jump. Alice and Stanley's son, Max, came into the kitchen and plopped down on the stool next to his sister.
What's for lunch, Mom?
Shelley rolled her eyes at her little brother. You are a grown man. Go to the luncheonette and buy your meal. Max laughed.
But Mom feels needed when I come by for lunch, don't you, Mom?
Alice Barnes stood by the stove with her hands on her hips and took a good look at her children. They turned out pretty well. Shelley was happily married with a grown son, and Max had taken over the plumbing business last year after his father retired. He hadn't married yet, and he was hitting on 44. He was living with that woman, Rosie, but Alice didn't look for Max to marry her. All in all, she thought her children had turned out fine. I don't think either of you really needs me, but I know you both love me, and for that I will fix lunch for all of us. Max, will you go tell your dad lunch will be in 20 minutes? He is out in the garage tinkering on something.
Anything for you, Mom.
Max kissed his mother on the forehead as he walked by. 2. Diagnosis.
You moved my razor. I hate it when you do that,
Max Barnes accusingly said. Alice Barnes sat on the edge of the double bed she had for so many years shared with her husband. How many times had she found shit stains on his side of the bed recently? About as many times as she had found his soiled underwear hidden in the nightstand. Alice wanted to talk to Stanley about wearing adult diapers at night, but she couldn't bring herself to do it. She had yet to tell Stanley that she had made a doctor's appointment for him. Stanley hated to go to the doctor. It seemed he hated it more so in the past couple of years. Alice wondered if he didn't already suspect something.
"Stanley, I haven't moved your razor. It's on the second shelf, just like it has been for nearly 45 years.
Alice tried to remain patient, but his accusations had become more hateful.
"I'm meeting Caroline later, and I want a good shave. She doesn't like the stubble, says it rubs her raw,"
Stanley rambled.
"What did you say?"
Alice couldn't believe her ears. Caroline was the lady she had once thought Stanley was having an affair with. She had seen Stanley's business truck in her driveway on more than one occasion. This was nearly 20 years ago, and he had been steadfast that it had been strictly business. He had told her that the contractor had installed faulty plumbing, and it had taken several trips to correct everything. Alice had accepted her husband's word and dropped the subject. Stanley Barnes stared into the bathroom mirror, wondering why his wife's question had sounded so harsh. He couldn't remember what he had been saying, and now felt afraid. He ignored his wife and went on with shaving. Alice stood in the bathroom doorway.
"What did you say about Caroline?"
Stanley became flustered.
"What the hell are you talking about? I don't know a Caroline."
Somewhere deep in his mind, he knew this was a lie.
20 years ago, you knew Caroline Russell," Alice stated.
"What's that got to do with today?"
Stanley asked. Alice didn't want to push him too far, or he would never agree to see the doctor.
"Never mind. You have a doctor's appointment today at 10.
Stanley put down the razor and asked his wife,
"Why do I need to see the doctor?"
Alice Barnes was in no mood to argue.
"Just a routine check, Stanley. It's time for some blood work, that's all."
She hated the fact she had to lie, but it was the only way. Dr. Hensley had been their family's doctor for the past 15 years, and Alice was comfortable with him. When she had made the appointment, she made sure to let the nurse know that Stanley was unaware of the real reason for the appointment. Dr. Hensley shook hands with Stanley and Alice, and then he went on to ask the routine questions. He threw in a few not-so-routine as well to test Stanley's memory, which Stanley failed horribly. That's when Dr. Hensley proceeded to tell Stanley that he was concerned, and he wanted him to see a neurologist because he was displaying signs of early-stage Alzheimer's. Stanley was immediately on the defensive.
"Is it a crime for a 75-year-old man to forget a few things without it becoming a major ordeal? I think it's time for this family to get a new doctor."
Dr. Hensley tried to reassure Stanley.
"It could be that you are right, Stanley, but a few more tests would confirm that."
Stanley stormed out of the office and left Alice standing next to the doctor.
"I knew he wouldn't handle it well. I'll talk to him at home. Maybe I can change his mind. Thank you for trying, Dr. Hensley."
On the car ride home, Stanley asked,
"You did this? You put the idea of Alzheimer's in the good doctor's head, didn't you? I should have left you for Caroline when I had the chance."
Alice Barnes felt like her world had just gone topsy-turvy around her.
"You hateful son of a bitch! I have been faithful to you for 45 years, and now you tell me that there was a thing between you and Caroline Russell?"
"What are you talking about, dear?"
Stanley asked blankly.
"Oh, no, you don't. You didn't forget what you said that quickly. Don't think for a minute that Caroline wouldn't stick your senile ass in Agate Acres nursing home at the first sign of dementia. That place should be called Maggot Acres, from what I have heard about it."
Still sounding confused, Stanley asked,
"Why are we talking about nursing homes?"
"Because that's where you are going if you don't stop talking about Caroline Russell."
Stanley stopped talking. For now. That night, Alice phoned her grown children and told them about their dad. She left out the things he had said about Caroline Russell. As Alice rested in the guest bed that night, she thought about her life with Stanley. She considered the life they had shared to be a good one. There had been hard times, but no different from other marriages, she supposed. The one thing she found she could not get past was Stanley's fling with Caroline. Did he regret not having left her for Caroline? Why had he denied it 20 years ago when Alice had her suspicions? He could have left then. The children were already grown by that point. Then Alice's mind drifted to someone she had not thought of in years. She remembered how Bob the Butcher had always flirted with her, and how she had been so flattered. Alice could have had an affair of her own, but never for once considered it. Not seriously. Within a month, Stanley further declined to the point of him wanting to go for further testing. The diagnosis was Alzheimer's. He started medication. The benefits barely outweighed the nasty side effects. It was as though he lost contact with reality. Stanley began to stray from home. Alice wondered if perhaps he was searching for Caroline, so she drove him to her home, which was just a couple of blocks away. She no longer lived there, and the current residents had no idea where she had moved. 3. Prognosis. Things went on the same for a few more months until Stanley realized Alice was no longer sharing a bedroom with him. He couldn't get a grasp on what he did so wrong his wife wouldn't sleep with him. During one of the family Sunday dinners, Stanley announced he was leaving Alice. He told the family he had recently met another woman, and they fell in love. Max and Shelley looked to their mother for answers. "Your father has not met another woman. Not recently, anyway. 20 years ago, I questioned whether Stanley was having an affair with Caroline Russell, but at the time he denied it. A few months ago, when his memory became much worse, he began talking about Caroline, how he wished he had left me for her. I didn't tell either of you because I saw no reason for anyone else to be hurt by the things your father was saying." Max asked,
"What are we going to do now?"
Max's live-in was quick to add her 2 cents. "We can't move him in with us. I mean, our place is way too small." Shelley's husband, Griffin, added,
"Well, you can't expect us to take him. That would be too hard. For Shelley, that is."
Alice stared at her grown-up children, and she wondered how they would have reacted if it had been her that had an affair all those years ago and was now the demented one. Would they chalk it up to karma if they knew their dad had verbally abused her for decades and had an affair? "What do you want to do, Mom?" Shelley gently touched her mom's arm. "I love your dad. I never imagined it would come to this when we married in 1970. I guess no one does. The most logical thing would be to look at nursing homes." Stanley had gone to the living room shortly after his announcement, so he was not in the room while the rest of the family discussed nursing homes. Shelley offered, "I believe there is a place just on the other side of town. It would be close enough for all of us to visit frequently. I believe it's called Angel Acres." Alice corrected her daughter. "Actually, it's called Agate Acres. It was named after Gerald Agate. His family helped fund the construction of the place. I'm not sure that's the one for him." Max added,
"No nursing home will be good enough for Dad, but this one is convenient for us to visit, and that's a huge plus."
Everyone agreed. It took almost 3 weeks to get everything arranged, but the day came for Stanley to move into Agate Acres Nursing Home. Max and Shelley picked their parents up and drove them to the facility. Stanley was highly agitated. He knew something was going on. They were greeted by the administrator, who took them on a tour. She showed them the dining hall, exercise room, and large common room where they held various activities. She told them that all the residents just loved the bingo games and Friday night socials. Stanley sat down in one of the many high-back cushioned chairs and told them to go on while he rested. Alice looked at Stanley and then at her children.
She wondered if Stanley realized where they were. Max assured her he would be fine and that maybe he would even make some friends. Shelley held her mom's hand as they continued the tour. Upon their return to the large common room, they were surprised to find that Stanley had indeed struck up a conversation with another resident. A woman in a wheelchair, with a tuft of white hair on her head that stuck out on all ends like a baby bird, was parked next to Stanley. There was something familiar about the woman. She tried picturing the woman with bleached blonde hair and 20 years younger. Alice smiled as she realized the wheelchair-bound woman was the one and only Caroline Russell. She knew her quondam husband of 45 years would be okay in Maggot Acres after all. Chalk it up to woman's intuition. Alice encouraged her son and daughter to tell their dad goodbye. She thought it would be best if she went on to the car. Alice thought back on the day she found out for sure Stanley had cheated on her. It was then she started giving him the special pills. Sometimes a woman had to take matters in her own hands when everything she had was given over to a man. On the way home, Alice said, "I wonder if Bob's fresh-cut meats is still open. I have a craving for lamb chops." Max answered, "The last time I was there, Bob had gone high-tech. Hell, he had robots doing the butchering. Looked like fucking aliens to me." Bob the Butcher was indeed open for business, and there was still quite the sparkle in his eyes when he saw Alice step into his shop. Max and Shelley heard the same story over and over again for nearly 3 years. They hated to see their mother in such a state of mind. At least Alice Barnes was one of the lucky ones. No nightmares, like some of the other residents on the Alzheimer's unit. Instead, she simply lived inside this dreamlike story, where her husband Stanley was the sick one. This appeared to make Alice happy. What more could you ask from a devastating disease?
That was Cindy O'Quinn's Quondam, as read by Nicole Swanson. Nicole Swanson is an actor and producer from Augusta, Georgia, who has discovered she loves hiding away in her closet and telling stories to her loyal companion, Blackjack the Studio Dog. An occupational therapist in the Georgia corrections system, when not narrating, Nicole enjoys a good cup of coffee while sitting on her porch swing and listening to the rain on a dark and stormy night. Discover more of Nicole's adventures at NicoleSwansonVO.com. Thank you, Nicole. Our second Stoker-nominated tale comes from Nadine Aurora Tabbing. Nadine Aurora Tabbing is a writer, designer, and Shiba Inu enthusiast who lives in the Pacific Northwest with a very stubborn dog. Her stories about the various horrors and tribulations of work and labor have appeared in Strange Horizons, Reckoning, Flash Fiction Online, Utopia Science Fiction, and the anthology No Trouble at All from Cursed Morsels Press. You can find her online at suchnadine.com. Listen with me, children of the night, to Aurora Tabbing's An Inherited Taste, first published in No Trouble at All, June 2023.
When Felicia was born, Bea wept with relief. The weight of her family's sorrow had been growing for some time, without anyone to carry it but herself. So, with care, Bea started on her daughter early. She salted Felicia's milk and formula with murmured complaints. She pureed bananas and seasoned them with sparkling shreds of spite. She stewed potatoes and peas with stubborn little grudges, acidic, which also helped keep them well in their containers, and made only subtle hisses when she unscrewed the jar lids to ladle their contents into plastic blue spoons. It was how Bea was raised herself, just a touch of rancor at a time. She'd squirmed through years of spoonfuls droning down her throat, too, and was rewarded with a palate so fortified she could bear even the most bitter grievances with an easy laugh. Her husband, not so carefully weaned, couldn't stomach even the smallest disappointments. A bypassed promotion, a co-worker who laughed too loudly, the little engine light flickering in the car, a stubbed toe, his steak overdone on one end. His troubles made him slow, heavy, tired. On their first date, that first time he grumbled to her across the table about some old ex, she opened her mouth to take a brief, deep breath. The lingering boil of his disillusionment laid a grease on her tongue, which she swallowed alongside a mouthful of wine, hiding any residue behind a smile. He blinked. He straightened and rubbed his shoulders with obvious awe at their sudden lightness. "You see?" her mother had said when Bea told her he scheduled a second date. "You're all set now, Anna, for a cheaper price than school, and look, not even your father was able to give me this." A white house. A white fence. A large white car whose creamy leather seats purred and heated. Even with all that, her husband needed her more, just as Bea's mother had hoped for her. Traffic, slow internet, delayed work projects, taxes, bills. He couldn't get through it all alone. Each day the complaints were different, but they always tasted the same. Bea took them all, gnashed them into a paste while she cooed. Over the years, she became acclimated to it. Her throat hardly burned anymore. Her stomach hardly ached. She felt only the brush of rattling heat against her teeth, which she made herself bear with a calm smile. Then, one day, they stopped serving ramen in his office cafeteria, and his bonus didn't come, and an outside agency was given ownership of his project, and a client side-eyed his tie, which he later found grease on, grease that Bea should have seen and cleaned for him, because what else was she doing all day? Didn't she care that he could lose his job because of this? His whole career? Felicia was watching with wide eyes from behind Bea's legs. She'd grown tall enough now that her little fingers could curl into the back of Bea's knees. "Your tie? Oh no, I'm so sorry I missed that. Here, I'll fix it for you." Bea held out her hand. He yanked the tie from around his neck, balled it up, and threw it at her, missing her hand completely. Felicia dashed to pick it up, but before she could, Bea snatched it and Felicia into her arms. Then she walked upstairs, slowly, calmly, as her husband's voice swelled and rattled the walls. "Shh," she murmured, but it wasn't necessary. Felicia's eyes were dry, her expression pensive, as if puzzling over something new. She'd already learned to swallow her own tears before her father could hear them and come storming in to silence her with petulant roars about the peace he needed after a long work day. In the laundry room, B Gatsby swabbed and scrubbed the tie with a thumbprint of pale detergent, then took her time looping it over a hanger to dry, taking as long as she could. Once some time of quiet passed, she led Felicia back downstairs, where she poured a small cup of milk that Felicia drank without even a flicker of distress at the flung bowls and spilled stew that littered the kitchen. Bea felt a stirring in her, something new, a strange little sharpness of hope. "You are so strong," she told Felicia, clutching her close once the mopping was done. "Stronger than him, stronger even than me." More than that, Felicia was hungry. She crunched carrots and apple slices as she sat on the counter, legs swinging. As Bea cooked, she spared Felicia the best bites of breakfast and lunch and dinner. Felicia had suffocated her own aspirations for the privilege of this beautiful white house, old hopes for her future that were too big to support alongside her husband's abundance of calamities. She told Felicia about each one, her own choicest morsels. A degree in landscape architecture, a side gig singing, even one saccharine daydream of opening a shop to sell only made from scratch macarons. All were pried out stinging, and Felicia was eager to hear each one, her hands reaching. "Tell me more," she said, and Bea, indulgent, continued. She told her of the recipes she'd inherited and kept hidden away, because her husband hated the smell of vinegar and fish sauce. "Tell me more," Felicia said, and Bea, hesitant, continued. She told her of the friends she'd lost and was forbidden to see again, each name a rancid tang. Jeanne, who'd said, "A white house isn't worth this." Skylar, who'd asked, "And eating someone else's sorrows? That's all you think you're good for?" "Tell me more," Felicia said. "Tell me more." And Bea tried. She tried. There was so much more yet. The mornings she woke alone, the years of sidelong thoughts she had not been able to share with anyone, the fact that she had always wanted a house that was green. But Bea could not release any of these. She only coughed, struggling for breath around the knot in her throat. That was the problem with swallowing sorrows. When they were lodged too deep, it was hard to push them out again. Eyes watering, Bea gazed at Felicia and found she could not disgorge her deepest and first sadness, forced between her teeth and planted in the pit of her stomach soon after she was born. "My mother said this is how it always was for her, and so how it always would be for me. She said this is what's needed to survive a world ruled by unhappy men. And I always accepted it. But now came a newer sorrow. I don't want this fate to be yours." It was slick and sour, the sharpest sadness she'd ever tasted. Even after years of experience, Bea couldn't make it go down. It kept heaving up, so when her husband came home, fuming about lazy staff members, she could only barely manage to say, "That's awful. You don't deserve that. No one deserves that." She couldn't make it sound the way it needed to. His eyes fixed on her immediately. "You don't mean that." "I do," Bea said, and then again, forcing her tongue through a thickness. I do. Felicia watched, silent, chewing her thumb, absorbing, just as Bea had when she was young, hanging on to the tranquil lilt of her mother's words, memorizing and tracing the way she bent backwards to every frustration. She'd survived, and all it took was chewing through years of cleaning, cooking, laughing when no one thought she could understand the muttered gossip about her being nothing more than a mail-order bride, arriving all packaged up and shiny with all the necessary accoutrements, knowledge of how to cook red meat, how to inflate an ego, how to drain depression. She'd survived, in a space small and hard and cramped, no wider than the breadth of a smile. Felicia would grow up smiling for different reasons. She had to. She had to. Bea would make sure of it. The next morning, she packed their clothes, enough to cover a week on the run. She had no money to bring, but she'd had still enough to figure out this life. She could figure out another one, couldn't she? For the first time she could remember, she felt a stab of something in her chest that was hot and hopeful. She was reckless. She pulled out of the driveway and stared at the sky, breathless with how vast it looked suddenly, how endless, and how light she felt, having abandoned in that white house her every anguish and resentment. How many years had she thought her dragging feet and short breath was simply what living felt like? How long had she nursed all of that in her, devouring her and her husband's misfortunes both, so that only he had freedom to move like this? But when they made it to the highway, Felicia began to whine loudly, and only kept getting louder. She thrashed in the car seat. She clutched her belly. She screamed.
Mama, I'm hungry.
There was a rest stop not far ahead. Bea peeled into the parking lot and clawed through the luggage, murmuring urgently, unraveling plastic wrap, unscrewing a thermos. But Felicia would not be sated by sandwiches or crackers or petty worry, nor even by the stress that boiled up in Bea's chest when passerby began to stare. Felicia swatted away the spoon her mother leveled before her mouth, splattering sauce on the car's leather seats. She continued to sob, inconsolable, starving. She only calmed when Bea's hands lowered with pained resolution. Bea turned the car back. She pulled into the white house's garage, dabbed the leather seats in desperation, unpacked her life back into its cage. Felicia's tears dried.
"The car's parked too close to the door," her husband said when he came home.
Even expecting his suspicion, having spent the past hour stealing herself for it, Bea cringed.
"It's not grocery day," he continued, low. "Where did you go?"
"Nowhere," Bea wanted to say, but he would have checked the gas level. She said, "We ran out of steak." It was plausible. She was already in the process of tenderizing dinner to hide her shaking hands. She had never lied to him before, had never risked it. She buried and armored herself in his disquiet, learned the borders of his temper, retreated when necessary, and never trespassed far enough to give him reason to do more than raise his voice. But now, God, if he made a move toward Felicia, Bea was ready. She steeled herself. She could take this tenderizer and
be sure to buy enough next time.
he said finally. It's a waste of gas, and I don't want to have to keep remembering things for you. I have enough to worry about. God, the day I had.
He kept going. No shouts, no demands. He was letting her off the hook. Odd, she could hardly listen. And so when he paused and waited for her to dole out her usual comforts, Bee fumbled.
I'm so sorry, Papa,
Felicia volunteered.
That's awful.
Both parents looked at her, as if seeing her for the first time.
That's right, he said. It is awful. You get it, Felicia.
And before Bee could think of some strategy to stop him, he went on.
You know what else? I'm positive one of those assholes filed a complaint against me.
Oh, no,
Felicia said, nearing him, eyes wide.
Oh, no is right. It's the third complaint on my record now. What do you think that'll look like on my performance review?
Felicia licked her lips.
Bad?
That's right. Bad. Fucking terrible. Hideous. I could lose my job. I could lose my whole career.
And then where will you be, huh?
You and your mom, useless here at home, not knowing anything about how to survive in this world.
He went on. He didn't hold back, not even to a child. But Felicia was nodding and leaning and reaching out. And then her father took her into his arms, jogging her, pacing, and all the while ranting and ranting and ranting. As Bee watched, Felicia wrapped her arms around his neck, rested her head against him, eyes shut, relishing. Bee felt her husband's misery radiate against her lips. That heat, that bite. And as she had countless times before, she opened her mouth and felt his fury coil into the pit of her stomach. Pungent, salted, like fermented vegetables. Cabbage or radish or something with crunch. So fresh that when she laid a hand on her belly, she could almost feel it squirm. She didn't fight, as she always had. Took a breath, let herself relax, let herself digest. For just a moment.
Fucking exhausting, her husband was saying. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of feeling this way. God, why am I the only one that ever feels this way? You never fucking lift a finger to help me. My life is a wreck. I can't handle this. I can't.
For the first time, she saw that perhaps he really couldn't. He was slumping with the weight of it. More sorrows than any one person could possibly bear. It must be so hard, Bee said. That you're going to be trapped forever in some miserable company? If not that one, then the next. That no matter how hard you work, you'll hardly have enough to retire. He looked up at her, agape, eyes dark.
What? What are you saying?
That's what I hear all the time. On the news, while I'm cooking, a recession coming, all the layoffs, and everyone's saying it's just a way for these awful companies to make you scared enough not just to stay, but to give everything for their deadlines. He stared at her. Felicia clutched him as his arm slackened slightly. Bee took Felicia from him,
kissed him, held his hand, guided him to the dining table, gave him his steak, his wine. "But don't think about that too much. There's nothing you can do about it. And don't let it go to your head. They're saying stress is the new smoking. It's just as dangerous. That it'll get you sooner than anything else nowadays." His first glass went fast. B poured him another, which Felicia helpfully pushed closer to him until his fist unclenched to take it.
"I can't handle this,"
he said toward the distance.
"I can't."
B dragged up a chair beside him. Gently, she set Felicia down on his lap, where she leaned against him and set her ear against his beating heart, inhaling, chewing delicately, savoring. Together, they smiled as B patted his back, as she murmured into his ear, "Go on, darling. Tell us more."
That was Nadine Aurora Tabbing's An Inherited Taste, as read by Crystal Hammond. Crystal Hammond is a narrator slash writer, cancer survivor, and non-binary queer human. They grew up in rural North Carolina, nurtured by a steady diet of local Blackbeard legends and Confederate ghost stories. These nuggets of folktale and myth fostered a lifelong love of storytelling and all the drama that goes with it. They also have a master's degree in biological anthropology and adore ugly cats. Feel free to check out their narration website at crystalhammond.com or find them on Twitter at @thekmhammond. Thank you, Crystal.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Our final Stoker-nominated tale for tonight comes from Sam J. Miller. Sam J. Miller's books have been called must-reads and bests of the year by NPR, Entertainment Weekly, USA Today, and O, the Oprah magazine, among others. His short fiction has been published in places like The Kenyon Review, Vogue Italia, Tor.com, Asimov's, and more. He's received the Nebula, Locus, and Shirley Jackson Awards. He's also the last in a long line of butchers. Sam lives in New York City and at samjmiller.com. Children of the Night, Join me for Sam J. Miller's If Someone You Love Has Become a Verdilac, first published in The Dark Magazine, July 2023.
My brother, on my front porch, wailing my name, soaking wet and without a jacket in the cold spring rain, with nowhere else in the world to go, wondering why I won't let him in. My brother crashing at our mom's house, preying on her weakness the way he always did. Me calling her every day and waiting for when she'll let it slip that the TV is missing or a credit card is gone. My brother phoning at 4 a.m., begging for $50, but forgetting the username of his latest account on PayPal or Zen or Venmo or Cash App, the previous one having been shut down like all the others for fraudulent activity. I think of Plonk now, and it's shit like this that comes to mind, which is so profoundly fucking sad, it makes me even madder at him. We're twins. Our first 15 years were a bubble of shared bliss and ill-advised adventures, secret language and all, us against the world. But now, his name pops up on my phone, or an old friend asks how he's doing, and I don't think about jumping fences to steal apples from a neighbor's orchard, or dressing identically to engage in uncanny performance pranks in public. I think of my brother's hollow, sunken eyes across the Thanksgiving dinner table. 6 Thanksgivings ago, the last one he was invited to. I think of my brother debasing himself in a sleazy non-studio porno film clip a so-called friend sent me. Planck and Faraday, named by our mom after 2 scientific constants, meant to be universal and unchanging for each other. But the only constant in Planck's adult life has been addiction. It's a common misperception that Verdilacs are a subspecies of vampire. True, both creatures are dead and drain the life force of the living, but ethno-archaeological studies have traced distinct lines of descent. Vampires, as everyone knows, originated in Egypt, and while scientific consensus on the origin of the Verdilac is lacking, most researchers believe it was Eastern Europe. The first known use of the word is in Russian, in a poem by Pushkin, and scholars still argue whether he made it up or was merely citing a folkloric tradition that had not been previously recorded. For nearly a century, Verdilacs were said to subsist on blood, but this is now believed to be a relic of an earlier scholarly period when parahuman subspecies were less well understood, and intermediary strains outside the primary taxa of vampire, werewolf, and zombie tended to be grouped in with one of those. There are documented cases of Verdilacs consuming blood, but this is typically ascribed to confusion about their own mechanism of feeding or a desire to be erroneously believed to be vampires. The simple, unique, horrifying defining characteristic of the Verdilac is this. Post-mortem animation can only be sustained by feeding on people who love them. Strangers and mere acquaintances are toxic to them. Verdilacs can only derive nourishment in the presence of actual love. Vampires can make ethical choices about who they feed on and how. Verdilacs have no such freedom. death was just another step on the long, rocky staircase down to rock bottom for Plank. I don't know how or when it happened, just that one day he showed up a lot paler than he'd been before, shunning sunlight more than normal, prone to showing me shitty party tricks like cutting himself and no blood coming out. I've asked around. Nowadays, every gay guy knows a Vertilac or two, just as we all have friends who've fallen victim to Tina, a.k.a. Christina, a.k.a. Crystal Meth. I'd already heard about the addict cuddle puddles. A group of crystal heads will get a hotel room and spend days fucking and slamming and sleeping, splitting costs and steadily lowering standards, losing touch with reality. Turns out, Vertilacs love that scene, since they swiftly consume or alienate everyone who loves them. They have to form new attachments, get new folks to fall in love with them. So they find a drug-addled orgy on Grindr, show up, fixate on someone drugged out and desperate and in the grip of extreme feelings, show them a little kindness and a lot of sexual availability, and bam. Give it a couple of days, and that person has fallen in love with them, which means they can feed on them, and maybe turn them. So I figure that's how it happened. He ended up at an orgy on a Tuesday, and was food by Friday, a monster by Monday. Plank was always one to fall in love fast. That's something that's true of me, too. But the silver lining of finding out at 15 that you have an astonishing genetic propensity for addiction is you learn what danger signs to steer clear of. I lost my brother, but I gained boundaries, walls I could build around my heart. So I never experimented with any substances, and I learned not to trust or indulge my own needs. Sex was fine, sex was easy, but love was work, was stress, was risk. I steered clear. Vertilacs are believed to be the smallest in population size of the confirmed supernatural subspecies, and certainly the least studied. Most scholarship on the subject originated in either the USSR or the USA, and throughout their existence, both nations were notorious for the unethical standards of scientific treatment of sentient creatures, the dubiousness of consent in their historic research traditions. A Soviet paper from 1979 remains the most cited, and while it's clear from reading between the lines that the study subjects were incarcerated and their participation was not voluntary and possibly induced under extreme duress, no subsequent investigations have disproven its primary data. Chief among them, this tidbit that accounts for another major difference between Vertilacs and vampires. You can't become a Vertilac by accident or against your will. You must consent to it. You must embrace it. God help me. I Googled it. I Googled Vertilac feeding. A man on the floor, his body twisted at an unnatural angle, like he was in the middle of writhing away from something when he froze. A child squatting behind him, pressing her forehead to his neck. A woman off camera, wailing, "Sweetie, that's your daddy. Please, sweetie, stop. That's your daddy. You're killing him." "Skin-to-skin contact is all it takes," said a comment. "Fake," said another. "That dude died," said a third. I Googled Vertilac interview. I Googled Vertilac starved. I Googled Vertilac in sunlight. That one I had to watch with the sound off. and even then, it was way too much. Half of what I found was bullshit, and the other half was so horrific I prayed it was also bullshit. I swore to stop Googling. 3 p.m. the next day, a text thread from Plunk. I wondered if it meant he was up early or up late, whether Vertilax lived fully nocturnal afterlives. I had so many questions, and every time I called him up or sent a text to try to have a conversation, he asked to come over. So I stopped trying. I'm not our mom. I'm not letting him anywhere near me. I visited Alavi this weekend, he says. An ex of mine. Don't worry, I didn't pretend I was you. I know he knows you have a twin, so I figured he'd figure it out. He must really still be hung up on you if he agreed to see me, and then agreed to invite me over after he saw what I look like these days. His love for you was fucking delicious. The life force of strangers is usually so sweet it makes me retch, and so toxic I'll become catatonic if I take more than the tiniest amount. But his was dizzying. So weird how that works. Like his love for you was almost love for me. But it didn't fill me up, no matter how much I drank. They kept coming. I didn't respond. Alavi had been a brief fling for me. A fun Fire Island weekend and a few balmy city summer weeks. It never occurred to me it might mean more to him, that his feelings might be so strong that a monster could taste them years later. Or maybe I'd known. Maybe I'd seen it in his eyes and run screaming for the exit. Or the mechanism was even weirder, a subliminal scent of affection that had me breaking it off with Alavi without even knowing why I was doing it. Maybe my whole life I'd done too good a job of protecting myself. One more thing to blame Plonk for. I started going through the mental Rolodex, the empty swamp that has been my relationship history, wondering what flowers could have blossomed into something big, the paths that could have brought me somewhere other than my present utter aloneness. Here's the thing I've been trying not to say. Mom's sick. She hasn't said so, but I see the familiar haunted, ashamed panic in her eyes when I video call, and the dark circles under them. Mom's sick, and I know it's Plonk. When he shows up on her doorstep wailing for help, she invites him in. Except now he doesn't just take the cash out of her purse. He sucks the life force right out of her. So obviously I'm not thinking straight, doing dumb shit, so desperate that I've turned to cheap, sanctimonious pamphlets from some quasi-religious recovery center I found at my doctor's office. So, someone you love has become a Vertilac. Please accept our heartfelt sympathies and validation of any fear or anger or grief you may be experiencing. The toll-free number and website provided are staffed 24 hours a day should you need counseling or emergency assistance. Because Vertilacs are so poorly understood compared to other scientifically documented supernatural post-humans, we have attempted in this pamphlet to shed some light on their history and operational realities and mechanisms of action. But please understand that this is no more necessary for you to know than the logistics of the pharmaceutical industry's dishonest opioid marketing would be if a loved one became addicted to OxyContin. We know you have questions. But in the end, an addict is an addict. And sometimes understanding them is dangerous. I showed up at Alavi's place. I don't know why. To make sure he wasn't dead, I guess. not Verdalakified, but also I wanted to see what I felt when I saw him, whether I could feel anything. I didn't just ring the doorbell. That felt invasive, something you do only when tacit consent has been given, if you're the delivery person showing up with the meal they ordered, or the hookup arriving for the encounter they specifically asked for. I texted him from the sidewalk. Surprise! Sorry to show up unannounced. My brother said he saw you, so I figure I've probably got some apologizing for his bad behavior and maybe for mine. Can I come up? Or can you come down and we go for coffee if you'd prefer? It was a little shitty, a little manipulative, banking on his feelings for me, that he'd want an apology, that he'd hope that this was a sign I'd gotten over my shit and maybe we could start from scratch. I didn't see it until I'd sent it, but once I had, I felt like a fucking jerk. The door buzzed. I pushed through instantly, on reflex, honed over dozens of visits in apartment buildings all over the city, where the door buzzer didn't last long enough to make it through both doors, and I had to endure the agony of ringing them up again. So many one-off encounters. So many strange buildings. So few dates. So few boyfriends. What if I was an addict after all? Hooked on anonymity, on boys I'd never see again, self-medicating with meaningless sex. Hey, Alavi said when he opened his apartment door. Sunlight filled the space with no apparent ill effect on him. He looked healthy, but he looked sad and he wouldn't hold eye contact for more than a fraction of a second. What a surprise! Sorry, I said. I know this is super weird, but I was worried about you. My brother's, Yeah, he said, turning and beckoning for me to follow him into the apartment. I know. What do you know? I said. I'm just wondering what he told you. It'd be just like Plank to cop to being a crystal addict, but omit the bit about being post-mortal life force sucker. Want tea? He asked. He told me he's one of those, the vampires that don't drink blood. A Verdalak. Alavi shrugged, put the pot on to boil. The kitchen was a mess. He hadn't been expecting anyone. If it was me, I'd have been angry. To have my disorder exposed to outside eyes. But Alavi seemed fine with it. A short, chubby, bearded, beautiful man who I had done wrong. Are you okay? He told me he fed from you. Alavi laughed at the double entendre, looked at me cynically. Yeah, I'm okay. It was nice at first, a really good feeling, a little like E, you know, blissful, ecstatic, a feeling of a deep, real bond with someone. But then I started to get dizzy, sick, nauseous. I tried to tell him to stop, but I couldn't speak, couldn't move. I panicked, thought he was going to kill me. But he stopped. It really didn't go on super long. Did he ask first, before feeding? He did, he said, avoiding eye contact again. But you know me. Once sex gets started, I never could say no to whatever crazy shit someone asks me to do. I didn't know him, not like that. Or had I? Had I also asked for something he hadn't wanted and he'd agreed because he valued my affection more than his own safety? His need for intimacy overpowered his self-respect? I know this is inappropriate, I said. It's a conversation I should be having with him, but I can't risk letting him get close. It's okay, Alavi said. And I wondered if this was why he said yes when Plonk came knocking. If he let him suck him dry in the hopes it might bring me around. We were both broken, me and Plonk, two monsters fighting a proxy war with stand-ins like Alavi and our mom. And did he ask if you wanted to become like him? The theory is you have to choose. You can't become one against your will. Alavi shook his head. No. But I asked afterwards how it happens, not because I wanted to, but because I was curious. He said he'd never turned anyone, and that he didn't want to because he knows it's super fucked up, and he wouldn't want to put anyone else through the hell he's been through. Said the guy who turned him did it because he'd already burned all his bridges, couldn't get into any of the sex parties where he used to find dudes to, you know, get to develop feelings for him. Apparently, Plonk would be able to access a lot of spaces that were closed to him, and then could let dude in. Something like that. I was a bit dizzy, out of it, wasn't fully following him. He got up to pour out the tea, brought two mugs. I sat, and I watched steam uncoil in the late afternoon sunlight. I sat, and I wanted to say something, but I couldn't. Eventually, I took a sip of tea. Ginger, an instant Caribbean brand that came from powder, so strong it made my eyes smart. But he said something else, Alavi continued, and I didn't want to hear any more. Didn't want to be there with this boy who cared about me, who I'd hurt. Didn't want to make him open his veins for me anymore. But cutting and running was selfish, was what I always did, so I sat, and I sipped, and I smiled, and I listened. He said he wouldn't want to turn someone, but that he might. Sometimes he can't control himself. Sometimes he gets the need so bad, and when he starts to feed, it feels so good. He does really, really bad things. There is no therapeutic consensus around how best to navigate a relationship with someone who has become a Vertilac. Most mainstream treatment centers counsel treating a Vertilac like you would any addict you cared about. Make sure they know that you're available when they are ready to get help. Stay in their lives enough that they trust you and will be open to your support when they're ready to seek sobriety. But that attempts at deeper, more meaningful interactions are dangerous, both to you, as they'll try to take advantage, and to them, as these relationships can become enabling and stop them from seeking the help they truly need. But here at Sky Island Lighthouse, we are unequivocal. There is no safe way to keep a Vertilac in your life. Only heartache can come from it. Because for a Vertilac, there is no such thing as sobriety. No hope of recovery. Even though I knew it was idiotic, I went to see my mom. I called her first to make sure Plonk wasn't there. She said he was in the city for the weekend, which his social media posts seemed to confirm, so I felt sure I was safe from seeing him. But still, it was dumb, dangerous. Because me and my mom are the same. We each have our kryptonite, the person we can't say no to. For her, it's Plonk. And for me, it's her. He was feeding on her because she still loved him. Possibly the last one who did, who would let him within 50 feet. But feeding on her wasn't the end of it. He would turn her. The one who could always do what he asked. The one I couldn't shut out. He would turn her to get to me. And she wouldn't want to. But if he begged her, if he said how much he needed her, if he said how much pain he was in, pain that only she could help end, she'd do it. I was the one he wanted, the one who loved him most, because the love was still there. He knew it and I knew it, even if the love was mostly outweighed by the hate. There's much more to be said about Vertilax than we could fit into this pamphlet. Please visit our website for more resources. Use password VURD4L4K to access the Crisis Options section. I'm fine, she said, chain smoking on the porch and looking like she'd racked up 10 more years than the 65 she actually had. He's killing you, I said. I can't believe you can't see that. He would never hurt me, she said. He punched you in the face when you caught him stealing from your purse when we were 17, I said. That was different, she said. Those boys he owed money to, you know it's not. She knew. She shivered in her seat. It wasn't even that cold out. I reached out my hand and she took it, held it tight. Felt like her bones had shrunk. I was still on the porch at 3 a.m., alone, when Planck returned. Faraday, he called, my brother's voice unchanged, swelling my heart so I almost wept. He stepped out of her car, so at least he had managed to keep from selling it, and the dim light turned him into the kid he'd been. My double, my heart. His face unravaged, his heart unmonstrous. Hey, bud, I said, and he ran up the lawn and wrapped me in the biggest, tightest hug I'd ever had. I braced myself. He could do it, take from me. His forehead was resting against my bare neck, skin-to-skin contact. But there was no bliss, no nausea, just Planck, the pleasure of him, the missing piece to my puzzle. I'm so fucking happy to see you, brother, he said, and I could hear the sorrow in his voice, the pain, the thirst. Thank you. I love you, buddy. If someone you love has become a Vertilak, know this. They need you more than anything on Earth, which means you are their greatest weakness. It's true that they can and will manipulate you, but they can be manipulated far more easily. Where are we going? He said, buckling his seatbelt. I want to have an honest talk with you, which means things might get heated, I said. I don't want Mom hearing. Cool? Cool, he said, the same sweet, cheerful kid he'd always been, the one that was buried for so many years beneath addiction, and then something even worse. Figured we'd go to the river, I said, where we used to swim. Where Mom caught us and tried to fucking kill us. Right, I said, cheerful, friendly, his brother, his twin. The legal status of post-mortal entities is complex, and different countries and provinces, as well as the USA successor states, have adjudicated them differently. Nothing contained on this website should be interpreted as intended to encourage or facilitate harm to a Vertilak or any other supernatural sentient being. It was easy. Of course it was easy. We sat on the bench facing east across the river, and we talked, and he was sweet and sad and trusting, and I didn't even have to rush. When I pulled the handcuffs from my pocket and snapped one around his wrist and the other around the metal arm of the bench that was embedded in the concrete of the boat launch. He could have easily twisted away before the fatal second click. "Faraday," he said, his voice unspeakably small and lost. "I'm so fucking sorry, buddy," I said. He'd never been bad. He'd just done bad things because he had to. But he'd always hated doing them. Hurting people or stealing from them wasn't in his nature. Neither was begging or screaming or cursing me out or breaking his own wrist, tearing his whole hand off to get free, flexing superhuman muscles that could snap the metal bench strut like wet paper. Which, for all I know, those are things Vertilax can do. "I love you," I said. "I know it doesn't seem like it, but I do." Plonk laughed. "Relax, bud. I know all about that. Loving someone but hurting them anyway." "It'll be quick," I said. "I watched videos about it." "Yeah," he said. "I watched those videos too. Lots of times." Bad as he was, he had always been the best in me. The part that was open to love and life and adventure and people. Now that I had him there, docile and defeated, and apparently not entirely unhappy at the approaching end, I could have asked him all the questions that had been building up in my brain about who turned him, what his name was, where I could find him to fuck him up, about what his life had been like, his afterlife, who else he'd hurt, what it was like being this, being him. But I didn't want to know anymore. With his free hand, he took his phone from his pocket. "Bad move, Faraday. You're a terrible murderer, leaving your victims with the means to call for help." But I didn't try to snatch it away. He turned on his camera, flipped it to selfie mode, angled himself so he was alone in the shot, started recording a video. "I'm sorry, Mom," he said, and breathed and smiled. "For everything." Then he set a schedule send for an hour after sunrise, so she'll think I did it to myself. That's what pushed me over the line into actual sobbing, which started him too. We held hands, and we wept. And after a very long time, he whispered in a voice made almost beautiful by need, "Can I?" I didn't answer. I didn't know the answer. "Least you can do, Faraday," he said with a boyish chuckle, "after you fucking murdered me." We laughed. And yes, I know, of course, it was crazy to even contemplate it. Maybe this sad, semi-suicidal embrace of his destruction was an act, a feint, a way to get me to let my guard down. Maybe a little nibble would be all he needed to knock me out, drain me dry. But he'd still die in that scenario, handcuffed to a bench with a corpse until the sun came up. I'd spent my life hiding from the harm love opens us up to. Who could quantify the harm it had done to me instead? "Yeah," I said. "Just a little bit. Just a little bit," he said, voice breaking. He took my head, turned it toward him, pressed his forehead to mine. It felt like summer. Like sunshine, like being 9 years old and finding yourself with sole custody of a forest, pine sap, honeysuckle, mosquito buzz, babble of a brook forever eluding us. I could see us, smell us, inhabit the memory, but only for a little bit. "Thanks, brother," he said in our secret language. "I'm sorry I couldn't help you," I said, "before." "I'm sorry," he whispered, and did not get specific. The words were big enough to cover all of it. We sat in the dark and cried together. Boys again. Brothers, no longer divided by a gulf of monstrosity. I'd joined him on the far side of it.
That was Sam J. Miller's If Someone You Love Has Become a Verdulak, as read by Andrew Gibson. Andrew was pulled feet first from the swamps of South Louisiana, kicking and screaming, and he remains mostly as such to this day. You can find his work on Audible under Andrew Gibson, or for the more romantically inclined, Blake Lockhart. You can also catch him streaming his recording sessions live in the Narrator Nook and the Haven Discord servers. Links are in the show notes. Thank you, Andrew. Well, children of the night, the hour is late, and we've run out of tales to tell. For now. Tales to Terrify is made possible by the tremendous generosity of our supporters on Patreon and PayPal. Incredible fans like Lesel Baxter, Paul Belcher, Amanda Carrillo, Amanda Gottfried, and Orion D. Higra, whose generous support helps keep the lights on and flickering ominously. Not a supporter already? Head over to patreon.com/talestoterrify. Where you'll find all kinds of perks, like ad-free episodes, bonus content, and one-of-a-kind collectibles and merch packs. Every dollar goes back into this show to make it as horrific as possible, and we appreciate it so much. Want another way to support the show that doesn't cost a cent? Head over to Podchaser, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating or review. You'll not only put an unnaturally wide smile on our faces, but help new listeners discover our terrifying tales, too. Why not share your love of the show out in the world with some Tales to Terrify merch? TalesToTerrify.com/merch will take you to our TeePublic store, where we've got a great collection of creepy custom and curated designs, so you can show those around you just how twisted you truly are. Tales to Terrify is produced by Seth Williams, Meredith Morgenstern, Andrew Gibson, Crystal Hammond, Spencer Disparti, and myself, Drew Sebastini, with original theme by Nebulous Entertainment. Tales to Terrify is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Join us again next week as we dive once more into the abyss for more Tales to Terrify.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details. If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.